Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We're talking about the war on drugs, the failed war on drugs, with Judge Jim Gray. You know, if the war on drugs has failed, and I think the evidence is pretty clear that it has, and in many ways, what's the solution then? Do we decriminalize? Do we legalize? Would that be true for all drugs, not just marijuana, but heroin, cocaine? We're going to get into that, as well as the international ramifications. Mexico, Colombia have basically been transformed into narco states. How would that be affected by a different kind of a policy? We'll get into that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Judge Jim Gray about the war on drugs, the failed war on drugs. Your Honor, you know, Mexico is a beautiful country. I love going there. I've been there many times over the years, enjoyed myself there. I wouldn't go to Mexico now. I wouldn't go to Cancun or Acapulco or anything. Today, two more heads were found in Juarez. It's a war zone down there. It's thoroughly corrupted the Mexican government, Mexican law enforcement, the military there. I just wonder if you could address what's happened in Mexico and why our country needs to be concerned about what's going on there because of drugs.
Well, George, it has almost nothing to do with drugs. They don't have a drug problem, but they have an absolutely mind-boggling drug money problem. And it's our drug money that has corrupted their police, their army, their safety, their way of life. Same thing down in Colombia or Bolivia or Peru, et cetera. So we just need to understand that as long as we have the market here, that someone will meet it. And we have now really, you can't say turned it into a failed state, but it's getting certainly close. They get more foreign money into Mexico because of drugs, even than oil or anything else. So if we were to change our system, which eventually we will, and by the way, once we change our system, everybody will then look back and be aghast that we could have perpetuated such a failed policy of drug prohibition for so long. But once we finally do that, we're going to have to be concerned about Mexico, because if we were to do that just as a brick through a window overnight, the whole system down, the economics of Mexico would simply fail. It's endemic. It's gone straight through their system. They've corrupted all kinds of people, and then the money flows through their country that way. So this is a huge problem. It's not a reason for us not to change our system here, but it's certainly something that we're going to have to be prepared to look at.
So
what do we do? You know, I mean, and that is the question in people's minds. And we were talking just when we began the program that there are options, and let's look at what's worked. And what we should do is to follow the lead of California, because this coming November, we will have an initiative on the ballot statewide, basically to treat marijuana like alcohol for adults. And I hope it passes. At the moment, it's leading. I'm going to ask anyone listening, if they're from California, to support this measure. And if you're not from California, you know people that can vote in California, communicate with them and ask them to support it. Because what would happen? Let's just walk down this road for a minute. If we in California were to treat marijuana like alcohol, what would be the result? And I have six results. The first five demonstrably beneficial. Then we'll talk about the sixth. The first thing that has happened is that we as taxpayers in California alone will save literally hundreds of millions of dollars that now we are spending in a futile effort to eradicate marijuana, as well as prosecute and incarcerate nonviolent marijuana offenders. And like we said earlier, you can tell how successful we are in eradication of marijuana, because it's still the largest cash crop in our state. Number two, as the chair of the State Board of Equalization determined, we could generate about $1.3 billion every year in tax revenue by taxing the silly stuff. And of course, last time I looked, we have a budget deficit in California. This would change that budget deficit by at least $2 billion a year. You'd think someone would notice. But the third thing, those are nice side benefits, but not a reason to change our policy. But this one is, because we would make marijuana less available for children than it is today. And you can ask any kids in California, they're teenagers, and they'll tell you the same thing they'll tell me, that it's easier for them to get marijuana or any other illicit drug, if they want to, than it is alcohol. Why? Because the alcohol is regulated and controlled by the government, and the illegal drugs are controlled by illegal drug dealers, and they don't ask for ID. Number four, then, we could, in effect, just turn around this whole medical marijuana dispute, which has basically been caused by people in the government who have not, even after 1996, when we passed Proposition 215 for medical marijuana, they still haven't put regulation, workable regulations into effect because they just don't agree with the law for some reason. So we could simply turn that around and just really pretty much put that to rest. And number five, we could revitalize the hemp industry, which it goes back thousands of years. It's a viable industrial crop. And we could talk about that one for an hour, George, but let me just bring that to a close by saying that in ancient Greek, the word cannabis and canvas were the identical words. You can go back to the old Ironsides, the USS Constitution. Its sails were made from hemp. It's the stalk of the marijuana plant. It has no mind-altering propensities in it at all, but they have enormous numbers of usages such that, for example, you can get four times the amount of paper pulp from an acre of hemp as you can an acre of trees. It takes 20 years to grow the trees and one season of about 8 or 9 months to grow the hemp. So those are five things that I think everyone would agree would be beneficial if, in fact, we were to pass this initiative and treat marijuana like alcohol. Then there's the sixth issue. And there, economics will tell you, just like it tells me, if you have the demand the same for adults with marijuana, but the price is reduced by about half, which, by the way, you'd have to do in order to drive the illegal dealers out of business, what's that going to do to demand? And the answer is the demand will increase, all things being equal, but soon we will start realizing that things will not be equal and we'll start experiencing what I call the Holland effect. Because Holland decriminalized marijuana about four decades ago, and the Minister of Health of Holland held a press conference, and I cite it in my book, Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed, and he said, you know, anyone 16 years of age or older in Holland can go to a coffee house and can get coffee and tea and sandwiches and also marijuana and hashish. But we only have half the marijuana consumption per capita in our country as you do in yours, listen to this, both for adults and for teenagers. And then he went on to explain why. George, you know what he said? He said, we have succeeded in making pot boring. Now, there's a message there because we glamorize it by making it illegal, and we also glamorize it by having an absolutely obscene profit motive for people to sell marijuana to you, your neighbors, and worst of all, to your children. And it's taken away. They only have half the marijuana usage in their country per capita as we do here, including for teenagers. So what's not to like? We should support this measure. It's going to change things enormously, and we're going to see that this is going to work a lot less harmfully than what we're doing today.
Characterize for me the experience with the marijuana dispensaries in California. The way it's been described to me is essentially it has legalized or de facto legalized marijuana. Anyone who wants a card can go and get one. They're cooperative doctors. If you've ever had a back pain or a toothache, they'll give you a card. So anybody can get it.
George, I think predominantly that's true, that you can find a place where you can get a marijuana card if you really want to, and then it will be furnished to you. Some, of course, dispensaries are just as integrity-laden as can be. I was taken on a tour, by the way, of a guy who was in charge of setting up the system in Oakland in California, and I was with him, and everybody knew him. He was the guy in charge, and they knew I was a judge, but they wouldn't let me into the dispensary even on this tour with him because I didn't have a card with me. And of course, I applauded that. I thought that was just great. But others are much less integrity-laden, and I understand that there are people that will take advantage of a system. I mean, are you shocked? Some people do. But yes, it's pretty well resulted in that. However, having said that, it has not increased marijuana usage. It just basically means that it's more regulated, and then it's taxed. Now, the marijuana consumption statewide did not go up. It's just that the consumption through the medical marijuana dispensaries is up, but otherwise they'd just be buying it from the Mexican drug cartels.
All right, let's talk about other drugs, marijuana being one thing, but what about methamphetamine, which is a terrible, terrible destructive drug? It ruins lives. What do you do with that? Do you decriminalize, legalize, what?
Well, honestly, what we should do is begin with marijuana, and then we can see what the results are and go from there. But really, the answer in this whole area is the concept of federalism. Now, I know that kind of sounds like egghead talk, but our country was founded on that. We have, in effect, 50 crucibles of democracy in our country today. 50 different states allow each state to decide how best to support, defend, protect its people, and then by trial and error, we'll figure out what works. And if, you know, Illinois comes up with something that works pretty well, Indiana comes up with something that's well-intended but just doesn't work very well, what's Indiana going to do? Well, they're going to start looking around saying, well, you know, Charlie, this is a good idea, but it isn't working. Wait a minute, what's going on in Illinois? Let's try that. And so maybe we'll extend it to methamphetamines, maybe not. Maybe for some states it would be beneficial to do it one way or do the other, because you have to understand, you know, this isn't easy, and there's no such thing as a perfect system. No one can design that. What we're trying to do is reduce the harms that can and will be caused because of the presence of these drugs in our society. Right now, we're going to great lengths to increase them. We've got to reduce them instead.
Is there are there mixed results from Denmark? You hear different kinds of reports out of Amsterdam that it has actually increased drug problems. Certainly, you've got druggies more obvious, more open in
you
public.
Do. And the problem in Amsterdam, and I have no resolution for this, the Minister of Health or the Chief of Police, they'll tell you, you know, we're a pretty small country. A full third of the people that use or abuse drugs in our country are foreigners, and we don't know what to do about it. You know, they'll come in from Germany or France or the United States to have a good time, etc. But the United States is so much larger. You know, we're not any concern, particularly to have people come in from Mexico or Canada or anywhere else. It would just be a drop in the bucket. So we're not going to have those problems. But yes, Amsterdam does have those problems because they're a fairly small country.
And heroin, you know, we talked briefly earlier about the English experience with heroin. There are people who can basically handle a maintenance dose of heroin and be productive people even though they're taking it, right?
They can and do. This program is enormously successful now in Switzerland. It began in the late 1990s. It's been adopted by the government. It's made permanent, that is, at least till through the year 2014, in every town and city in Switzerland. It's reduced crime. Why? Well, if people are even arrested if they're on the program, they're put off the program, which means that they, you know, they don't need to burglarize your car or your house anymore to get the drugs because they're much less expensive and they get them at pharmaceutical prices through the pharmacies. And so crime has gone down. Drug usage has gone down because, you know, what do people do today to support their habits for heroin or in our country? You know, yes, they'll burglarize and prostitute, but invariably they get larger amounts of drugs and then they sell them to you, your neighbors, and your children to support their habits. But if they're even arrested, they're off the program. As a result, you have fewer people selling drugs in the communities and fewer people using drugs in the communities. So drug usage has gone down. The program is markedly successful in Switzerland, and the only honest response or question that I've ever heard to this is, oh, wait a minute, we can't do this because you'd be sending the wrong message to our children. But honestly, George, what we should do instead of hiding programs like this from our children, I say take them there. You know, let them speak to these heroin-addicted people. Because what do you think they're going to tell them? Oh, yeah, my son, my daughter, follow my lead? Nonsense. No, everyone knows that being a heroin addict is not a good thing. They'll tell them the truth, you know. Son, the biggest mistake I ever made in my life was going down this road. You know how I got started? Oh, you know, I was at a party or somebody gave me a sample or I thought it was cool. Whatever their experience would be, they'll share it. That's honest education. These children will see, hey, that's not for me. That's not where I want to go. I can't think of any reason whatsoever why we should not have a heroin maintenance program clinic in every town or city in our country where there's a need. And I don't think that any of our listeners could come up with any either.
Let's go back to talk about Mexico for a second. I read a statistic that the global drug trade, illegal drug trade, is worth about $320 billion a year. Astonishingly, it's about 1% of all the commerce on the planet. And in Mexico, it represents about 10% of their entire national economy. I mean, as you alluded to, it'd be pretty tough to change that overnight. And I would imagine the cartels themselves would fight back. I mean, you know, the power, the money that they have, it really does represent a threat to our national security in the long run, and I would imagine they could be pretty influential using all the resources at their disposal.
George, it does. First of all, it's my understanding that the illegal drug trade is about the same, the equivalent of the international textile trade. It's one of the largest markets, source of revenues in the world. And then with regard to Mexico, the head of the DEA estimated that a full 60% of the gross revenues for the Mexican drug cartels comes just from the sale of marijuana. Well, wait a minute now. We're talking in California of treating marijuana like alcohol, regulating it, controlling it, raising it, probably through low-bid contract or some reputable organization. That's going to take away the Mexican drug cartel's market. And if you're making $100 million a year selling illegal marijuana, I assure you, you will spend $10 to $15 million to protect your market. So I'm anticipating in California alone, millions of dollars will come in from Mexican drug cartels in advertising and all kinds of things as to why we should not pass this initiative, because they're going to try to protect their market, which makes perfect sense from a economic standpoint. I suppose I'd do the same thing if I were in their position. We're going to just have to be ready for it because it's coming.
Help me with a worst case scenario picture of what could happen in Mexico if this is left as it is.
Oh, they are in the throes of a war. I have been to El Paso in about four months ago, and of course that's right across the dry Rio Grande River from Ciudad Juarez, where they are bleeding. They have lost thousands, I think 6,000 people to have been killed violently because of the recent crackdown by President Calderon. We are so arrogant here in our country, telling that the Mexicans should fight harder to, in effect, solve our drug problem. You know, Mexico, as we said, doesn't particularly have a drug problem. They have a drug money problem, and they're the ones that are having to do this. I got to tell you, if I were in Mexico, I would legalize these drugs real fast, allow the government to tax them, make money on them. It's not going to increase the supply of drugs into our country, but it will take away the violence. They are bleeding. And this is ironic, but President Calderon, and I don't fault his motives at all, he's trying to do what he believes is the right thing by instituting this huge war on drugs down in Mexico, and he's been doing it now for like 27, 28 months. Mexico, prior to that, did not particularly have a drug problem. Like we said earlier, you know, they have drug money problems, but now that he has tightened the screws down on this stuff, if I am a big drug lord and you are my lieutenant, I used to pay you in dollars, but now it's a little harder to get the dollars, so now I pay you in drugs. George, if you are being paid in drugs, what are you going to do with the drugs? You're going to start selling them in your communities, which is exactly what's happened. And now, because of the crackdown by Calderon, we have a lot bigger amount of drug problems in Mexico because people are now starting to use drugs, again, caused because of our drug money and they're tightening the screws of the war on drugs, which is exactly, of course, what we've experienced in our country. It couldn't have been worse for their country, not only bleeding and dying and stuff, but because of the drug problems. I believe that if we were to repeal drug prohibition, it would be the biggest safety measure that we could encounter for our law enforcement officers here, as well as, of course, in Mexico. And all you need to do is cite, when we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition, homicides went down nationwide by 40% in 1 year and continued to decrease each year thereafter until the beginning of the Second World War. And I'm completely convinced that we will experience the same phenomenon when we come to our senses and repeal drug prohibition. It's about time that we get involved and do this.
Judge Jim Gray, if you need more information about his message here, he's at judgejimgray.com. You can read about his public positions and things he's written about the subject. We'll be back with more of our discussion about the failed war on drugs right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about the war on drugs with Judge Jim Gray. And, you know, it is an interesting point of view that he has, and he makes a lot of great points. I suppose we're not hearing from the other side. There are those who would say, yeah, the war on drugs has failed. in many measurable, demonstrable ways, but what would it be like if we didn't have it? Couldn't it be much worse if we didn't have it? They argue, for example, the former drug czar had said, without this, that drug use would continue to go up, that it actually peaked many years ago and has stayed pretty stable in the years since without because of the war on drugs. So it could be a lot worse without it. We'll get into that topic and maybe into a discussion of the CIA's involvement with the international drug trade right after this on Coast to Coast AM. The topic is the war on drugs with my guest, Judge Jim Gray. If you want to reach him or learn more about his work, you can contact him at judgejimgray.com. Your Honor, would you be a judge in Mexico? Would you you think you'd stick to your guns if you lived in that country? Would you sit behind the bench and sentence cartel members and drug offenders?
Well, I hope so, George, but you never really know until the threat is upon you. There have been lots of judges that have been killed in Mexico. Certainly in Colombia. I read a statistic with regard to Colombia that something like two-thirds of the mayors in the past 10 years have either died or quit or have been actually run out of town because, you know, their small towns are just ungovernable because the drug lords have not only more guns than the police but also more money. But unfortunately, a lot of times it doesn't make any difference because the police are on their payrolls anyway. So you just cannot underestimate the amount of harm, of corruption, of violence that big drug money in cash brings. Just ask yourself, have your listeners ask themselves the questions. You know, how much corruption could I buy for $1 million in cash? And the answer is a whole bunch. And that's what's going on down in Mexico and these other countries today, Afghanistan, you name it. That's what's happening. And it's our drug money that's doing it.
Yeah, you look at all these judges, cops, mayors, military officials who are just wiped out down there by the cartels. And I wonder, you being as outspoken as you are and at the forefront of this argument, whether you would be a target here because the cartels' violence has certainly spilled across the border.
Well, I told you that I was down in El Paso speaking at a forum a little while ago, and they had a part of the forum across the border in Ciudad Juarez. And I decided, you know, it's a foolish thing for me to do, being outspoken as a judge. I could be a target, and I just didn't want to do that to my family. You know, it wouldn't be that much benefit. Yes, you have to take these security matters into account. Honestly, I thought I would get death threats when I originally decided that I'd hold my press conference back in 1992. It has not happened, but you don't want to take, you know, needless risks either.
It's the threat that you don't get that you got to worry about.
Well, you got to worry about cowards, not only in this, but other things. You know, if anybody has an ounce of intelligence, they'll realize that if they were to harm me or harm prosecutors or other judges that would speak this way, that would just reinforce what we're talking about. It's the cowards you have to be careful of.
I don't know if you're comfortable getting into this, but we do discuss conspiracies of different sorts on this program from time to time. There's been a considerable amount of literature, documentation, articles about CIA involvement in drug trafficking. And the argument being that maybe they have used a drug involvement to finance all sorts of things, projects, things off the books.
George, I have two responses to that. Even in my book, I have a conspiracy theory chapter in why our drug laws have failed. And I don't have any particular firsthand information other than I read articles, but the articles or books are written by people who are at least in a position to know. And one person was a friend of mine, actually, is Rob Bonner, who was a federal judge and then resigned to become the head of the DEA under the first George Bush administration. I saw him on television saying, yes, he knew that the CIA had, in fact, brought in drugs into our country. It was back in the Iran-Contra situation where they used that in order to buy weapons for Nicaragua and stuff. And he was on the airwaves doing it. But the focus of my book is, because I'm not a real conspiracy theorist, but if people even think that this is true, that is enough harm in itself because they are afraid that, you know, the big money really is with the government. And they're talking about potentially millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. If people even think that their government or their agents are involved in this, that's enough harm in itself. So even whether it's true or not is almost academic, because the main harm is that, that government takes it on the chin and becomes a lot less effective because people think that the government is corrupt. So it almost doesn't matter if the government actually is. It's a major problem, and we have visited that on ourselves, certainly.
We look at Afghanistan. You know, we've got brave troops in there fighting against terrorists. We've got CIA guys, and I still think of the CIA as good guys, despite all the things that have been written about that agency over the years. They're putting their lives on the line as well, and that you've got this storehouse, this huge supply of opium poppies, and it we haven't eradicated it. It's there's more of it this year than there was last year, and next year there'll be more than this year. And I have to wonder about whether that's a matter of convenience for some people, for some agencies.
It is something that actually, if we destabilize their opium crop, they get mad at us. I think, from what I understand now, our agents have almost ceased trying to eradicate the opium poppies in Afghanistan, because it's so ingrained, because so many people need the income from it, which is, of course, incongruous, because guess where that stuff is coming. But it's just so endemic and so deep there. Look, you know, if I am a teacher in Afghanistan, I'd love to teach, but there are no schools. If I'm a plumber, an electrician, there's no work for me. The only way I can support my family, pretty much, is to raise the opium poppies. And you can do the same thing down in Colombia. You know, if I'm a campesino, if I'm way out in the hinterland, I'd love to raise bananas. But you know something? Bananas are heavy. I don't have any trucks. And even if I had a truck, there's no roads. But if I raise the opium poppy, or the coca, more likely, you know, I can carry that by hand 5-10 miles to the nearest town, or at least on my burro. So we go around and trying to convince people, hey, not growing your largest cash crop is good for you, and they laugh at us, you know, and it's just silly. So, you know, it's simply having to face reality that we have not done. And once again, George, literally, victory in the war on drugs is simply slowing the pace of defeat. It's inevitable that we will continue to make the situation worse for ourselves. And then I'd like, in a couple of minutes that we have now in this segment at least, to talk about Portugal, because you mentioned what's the other side. You know, some people, the drug warriors, whatever, will say, oh, the situation would get so much worse if we were to change our approach. Portugal, in the year 2000, recognized the reality that they had the largest drug problem of any European Union country. So they did something smart. They empowered a commission of non-political experts to look into the situation. And the commission came back in about a year and said, we have two issues here that we want to share with you. The first is that problem drug users are afraid of their own government. Why? Well, obviously, if they bring their problems to the government will punish them, so they take their problems underground. Number two is that the government is spending so much money investigating, prosecuting, and incarcerating problem drug users that they don't have any money left for drug treatment. So actually, Portugal in the year 2001, and people should know this, and for some reason the word has still not gotten out, 2001, Portugal decriminalized all drugs. Now, decriminalized means it's still illegal to buy, use, possess, sell any of these drugs, but as long as you stay within very well-known guidelines, usually with regard to quantity, the police are instructed in writing to leave you alone, look the other way. So as of 2007, the Cato Institute started studying the statistics between 2001 and 2007, and they came out with a report the year end of last year, around November or so of 2009, and said that drug usage in the entire country pretty much remained the same. If anything, it went down like 0.5%, which gives the lie, in effect, to the, oh, we're going to become a nation of drug zombies sort of thing, which is really kind of silly and even insulting if you think about it. But drug usage pretty much remained the same under that new system. But problem drug usage went down by 50%. Why? Because now people are taking their problems to the government, and the government has the money. Instead of using it to put them in prison, they're using it for drug treatment, and problem drug usage has gone down by 50%. Plus, children are no longer using drugs nearly as much as they were before. At least they're not beginning to, because, come on, why should I? What do I want to use drugs for and then have to go and talk to a doctor? I mean, that's no glamour there. So they're not beginning. The drug usage among children is actually being reduced even faster than elsewhere. So we should look and learn from this experience in Portugal, and we ought to disseminate this all across our country, because here is something that we really can learn from.
What do you say to those who would argue, hey, we're not Portugal, we're not Switzerland, we're much bigger, we're much different, our population is so much more diverse, our experience would not be the same as Denmark?
Fair enough. You know, we're not Portugal, we're not England, we're certainly not Switzerland, but those people have two arms, two legs, you know, a head. We can learn from their experience. Let's try it. Let's try it in one, you know, try it in Alabama, try it in California, try it somewhere, and see what works. Allow each state to decide how best to serve its people. And just like our initiative in California in November will be to allow each city to decide whether or not they want to have marijuana sold to adults within their city limits. And if so, how? Well, do you want to have it in a package store? Do you want it to be advertised or not? I sincerely hope no one advertises it or allow you to grow your own marijuana. I mean, they will allow each city to decide how best to do this. And then we will learn from everyone's experiences. What do we have to lose? We certainly can't do it worse than what we're doing now. Let's regulate it, control it, yes, tax it, make it less available for children, take the violence out of it, get the quality controls back. You know, my goodness, when we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition, alcohol usage pretty much remained the same. But the problem usage, you know, with the bathtub gin problems, the quality problems, they disappeared almost immediately. And the same thing will happen with regard to these other problems. I sentenced a man, George, for being under the influence of methamphetamines several years ago now. And before I gave him his sentence, he's entitled to make a statement if he wants to. Well, do you want to say anything, young man? Your Honor, yes, I do. That I want to tell you that my drug of choice is marijuana. And for years, I was buying marijuana from the same supplier. And then one fine day, unbeknownst to me, he sold me some marijuana that had been laced with methamphetamines. I smoked it a few times, and I got myself hooked on methamphetamines. I didn't want to. That's what happened. Now, I tend to believe him. He didn't have a reason not to tell the truth. He got the same sentence anyway. But that's a problem that we can address. The purity issue, the quality issue. We address those with alcohol. We address them with over-the-counter drugs. The FDA does a good job on that sort of thing. But today, the purity problems, you have no concept. You're going to take methamphetamines, which, again, scares me to death, but you have no idea what's in that stuff. If you're taking heroin, cocaine, you have no idea what it's been used to cut with. You know, you could certainly, baking soda would be good. You can have plaster also. You don't know. Now, those are problems that cause enormous health difficulties in our country. Those can be addressed. Bring people closer to the medical professionals that can help them instead of labeling them automatic criminals and pushing them farther away, and then hold people accountable for their worth, for their actions. So if they drive a motor vehicle under the influence, or they beat up their spouse, or they hit someone over the head with a pool cue, it doesn't have to be illegal, just like with alcohol, these substances. To hold people accountable for their actions, the problem drug users are going to find their way into our criminal justice system anyway, regardless of whether the drugs are legal or illegal. It makes perfect sense. If we address it from that standpoint, which eventually I promise we will reduce so many harms and decrease so many of these difficulties that we're inflicting on ourselves today.
You know, you don't want to belittle the drug czar and the work that he does, but it struck me a couple of years ago when Nevada was considering a marijuana decriminalization statute that the drug czar made two visits here to openly campaign against it. Here's the guy in charge of some pretty important policy initiatives, law enforcement role, and here he was acting as a PR spokesperson to maintain the criminal statutes for marijuana in Nevada.
Yes, and that was Walters, who, in my opinion, violated the law himself. That was a criminal act by using federal monies to oppose state initiatives. That is a violation of federal law, and he should be held accountable for that.
One of the arguments he made, though, and other supporters of the war on drugs have made, and it's a legitimate issue, is, you know what? All right, so the war on drugs has failed. We really don't know how bad the situation could be if we didn't have it. It could be much worse.
Well, you can certainly argue that, but you can go back before 1913, where, you know, no drugs were illegal nationwide, and we didn't particularly have a drug problem there. Honestly, I guess we have a couple of minutes. You know, prior to 1913, there were two groups of people in our country that were addicted to narcotics, and it's pretty hard to come up with them. The first one maybe you could come up with, and that was Civil War fighters, veterans from the North who had been injured, and unfortunately they were given too much morphine to cover the pain, and they became addicted to it to the degree that the Northern Civil War veterans were said to have the soldier's disease because they were addicted to morphine. The South actually didn't have the problem because they couldn't afford the morphine, so they just gave them the bourbon. But those were major people that were addicted. The second group of people you'd never figure out, and that was Midwestern agrarian housewives. Why was that? Because, you know, these snake oils that were going around, these snake oil stuff, you know, you'd buy Captain Billy's whatever, really make you feel a whole lot better? Well, it sure did, because it had 50% cocaine in it. But then we ran into the best, most effective legislation we've ever seen in this area, called the 1905 Federal Pure Food and Drug Act. That did not prohibit the sale of any of these things. What it did require was truth in advertising, truth in labeling. And when they made people put on the covers of these things, the labels of these bottles, 50% cocaine, people, I don't want to take that stuff. And it resulted in a complete loss of that entire industry, because as soon as people saw what was in the stuff, they stopped using it. But just because they were available, it didn't mean that people were going to use them. We didn't have the problem before. And honestly, I saw the results of a survey, and I couldn't track it down, so I didn't put it in my book. But the survey asked, let's say, 100 people two questions. If we were to legalize cocaine, would you use it? And of the 100 people, you know, 7 or 8 said, oh, maybe I'd try it, maybe I'd experiment. Okay. The second question on this survey was, if we were to legalize cocaine, do you think your neighbor would use it? And there, 80% of the people said yes. You know, it's almost as if you have 100 people standing in a circle, each one's pointing to the person on their right saying, I wouldn't, but you would. Well, that's just downright silly, but that's pretty much the argument that people make. It just is insupportable.
I read something to the effect that the Obama administration will make an announcement this coming week, a new approach to look at drug use as a public health problem as opposed to a law enforcement problem. And yet, while announcing that new approach, they will still put $10 billion of the $15 billion we spend on drugs at the federal level into interdiction.
It's the same old tired story. They give lip service to drug treatment. They give lip service to education, but they spend the money on incarceration. But honestly, that's where the money is. That's where the political power is. That's where the politicians get elected and reelected. You can give me a 5-second soundbite if I'm running for office, and I'll show you how tough I really can be. You know, okay, ready, go. Vote for Gray, I'll put those drug dealers in prison and save our children. Well, you know, it sounds good. It doesn't work, but that's what gets people elected. But you can give me a 30-second soundbite, and if I talk sense, if I talk about what works, education, treatment, I sound like a wimp. No politicians want to sound like wimps. So it's up to us as the voters to vote end of office people that will be smart about this issue, not tough.
Well, precisely the reason you mentioned makes me wonder if we can actually change this policy on a broad scale. We'll get into that and go to the phones with Judge Jim Gray talking about the war on drugs. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast.